Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1994, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a doctor. He was born and grew up in London, but since the mid-60s has lived and worked in America. In 1969, he treated catatonic patients with the drug L-DOPA, and briefly and miraculously, they came back to life. The book he wrote about the incident, Awakenings, inspired the film starring Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. He's written other books too. Although now a distinguished professor of neurology, he's reached out beyond the frontiers of medicine with his humane and literary accounts of his patients' illnesses. He is Dr. Oliver Sacks. Dr. Sacks, some of the case histories you've written about are strange beyond belief. Do you listen to the descriptions of their symptoms when they come to see you and think, my goodness, this is a good story? I mean, rather like a journalist.
At first, I don't. At first, I'm faced by a human being in trouble, although also a human being who's trying to articulate something which he can't understand and which is strange beyond imagination. Often at some point, the idea may come to me, this will be a good story or worth telling.
Let's take one of your most famous cases then, the Dr. P, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. He, in fact, did that very thing in front of you in your room, didn't he?
Oh, yes, indeed. He could see things clearly, but he couldn't interpret them. He got the meaning wrong, and when he went to reach for his hat, he got his wife's head, which was approximately the same shape.
And how did his wife react?
She was obviously used to this, and she gave a sort of tired, accommodating smile.
And he did this kind of thing all of the time. He patted parking meters on the head like children, didn't he?
Yes.
But what would he say, for example, if you gave him an ordinary everyday object and asked him what it was? Would he often not recognise it?
It would depend. If it had a simple geometrical shape, like this aspen box in front of me, he might recognise it. But if it was something complex like a flower, he might give a sort of strange, over-elaborate, pedantic geometrical description, but not get it. Like on one occasion he called a glove a receptacle with five outpouchings.
So, I mean, the rest of us, if we met him or saw that going on, would think he was completely batty, frankly. But he wasn't. It was something specifically wrong with his brain, but otherwise he functioned normally.
Yes, indeed, extremely well. And the rest of his brain, including the musical part of his brain, was superbly intact.
Were you able to help him?
Well, he was a very gifted musician, and in a sense, my advice to him was to try and organise more and more of his life through music. He was already doing this, in a sense, by inventing eating songs and shaving songs. And if he organised the bathroom according to a song, he could usually find things.
So you can often use music as a therapy in your work. How important is music to you personally?
I think extremely important, and I think it always has been. I can't live without it.
So what's the first record you'll take with you?
Well, for myself, mostly I love classical music, but I think the first record will remind me of an experience with a patient, a young man. He'd been a hippie in the 60s, and then he'd had a brain tumour and had lost his memory and, in effect, was marooned in the 60s. He used to be a deadhead, a passionate admirer of the Grateful Dead. One day, when the Grateful Dead were in town, I took him to a concert. I abducted him. I smuggled him out of the hospital. And in the first half of the concert, where there was only music from the 60s, this amnesiac man who hadn't registered anything after 1970 was totally at home. It was wonderful to see him. He knew all the songs and rejoiced in them. And in the second half of the concert, where they played songs from the 70s and the 80s, he was very bewildered and lost, and he said he thought this was music from the future. And this was uncanny to hear this, because, of course, this is a future he would never know. The next day, he didn't remember going to the concert. But, strangely, he did have a memory of some of the new music. This happened pretty recently, and I love the Grateful Dead myself. To my great surprise, I'd never been to a rock concert. I danced for 3 hours. I had an effusion on my knee for 2 weeks afterwards, but it was worth it. And so I think, atypical though it is, the Grateful Dead.
See that girl barefoot in the floor, whistling and singing, she's a carrying on. Got laughing in her eyes, dancing in her feet, she's a neon light finding, she dance on the street. Hey, 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 coming by.
Grateful Dead and the Golden Road. Can we talk, Oliver Sacks, about Awakenings, your book, which became a highly successful film, and it is, of course, the story of some 80 patients in a mental hospital in New York whom you, in the summer of 1969, awoke, as it were, from an immobilised, trance-like state which they've been in for decades. Tell me first why they were in that condition.
Well, all of these patients had had a viral illness, an encephalitis or sleeping sickness, which formed a worldwide pandemic just after the First World War. First, when I saw these people, I wondered, what's going on inside? Is there an inside? The nurses at the hospital, who'd been there also for decades, were convinced that there were intact people walled up in this. And they were convinced of this partly because of brief releases. Sometimes if a patient sneezed, he could move for 30 seconds. Mm. Sometimes if a fire engine might alert him for 30 seconds. So in this tantalising way, one knew they could be awakened for a few seconds.
And then there was this drug, L-DOPA, which you used or persuaded that you should be allowed to use because you thought it would wake them up, and indeed it did. Can you remember the moment when you first realised it was going to work?
I think probably with the patient I call Leonard, although in the documentary film which was made you see him and his name is Ed, his eyes became brighter. He became more alert. He started to look around. Though I think perhaps the most dramatic awakening was with another patient, one called Lola. And with her, there was no warming-up period at all. She suddenly came to
in
seconds.
Came alive again.
And she walked down the corridor and she burst into conversation. Now, I had thought theoretically this might happen, but it was absolutely unimaginable.
There were, as you say, lots of strange and emotional experiences connected with all of this, because suddenly women who'd gone to sleep as girls, as it were, looked in the mirror and discovered they were grey old ladies, and then others who discovered that they'd been, whatever, divorced, deserted, or left for balmy or dead.
Well, this was overwhelming with the patient, Rose, whom really Harold Pinter wrote about in A Kind of Alaska. When she came to, she burst out singing, and she was singing all sorts of songs from the mid-20s and talking about Gershwin as if he was still alive. And we wondered where she was, and she said, "I know it's 1969, but I feel it's 1926. I know I'm 64, but I feel I'm 21. She said, "I've been a spectator for the last 43 years, though I don't think she was even a spectator.
But was she? That's the question. You said earlier on that the nurses were convinced they'd been locked up inside themselves, these people. I mean, what a horror that must be if they had they?
Well, I don't think, in the case of Leonard's case, there was certainly a full consciousness and a sense that his body was a prison. With other patients, I think there was some strange sort of twilight of diminished consciousness and feeling, with sometimes occasional flashes when something would get through.
Let's have your second record there.
I think my first love, when I was a little boy, was Bach. I grew up in a house which was full of Bach, and I adore the liturgical music, above all the great B minor Mass.
Thank you.
Monteverdi Choir, conducted by John Eliot Gardner, singing the chorus Et Incarnatus Est from Bach's Mass in B minor. It must have been an incredible summer, that, the summer of 69, to watch these people who'd been written off and forgotten suddenly returning to life. Did the film capture the excitement well?
I think it did. The Leonard himself, when El Dopo originally came out in 67... he called the agent in the brain. He said he tapped out dopamine is resurrectamine. And I think the feeling of resurrection was overwhelming that summer.
He used to tap this out on a sort of spelling board,
yes,
didn't he?
Right, yes, one letter at a time. And certainly the initial feeling just of being alive and joy in this, I think, was very well captured.
But then things began to go wrong. The drug had side effects and the patients began to regress. What happened?
Everything indeed started to go wrong, in some patients in a few days and others in a few weeks. I think some of this was directly to do with the nervous system and the drug. I think this was one sort of problem. The other, I think, was a sheer identity problem, as with these patients who came to in their 60s, having not had a middle to their life.
In fact, it wasn't shown in the film, but Leonard, who went to sleep aged about 30 and woke up aged 52, he in fact became sexually obsessed, didn't he?
Well, certainly sexually excited. I don't know whether obsessed is the right word, but there was the whole ward was a place of great sexual excitement, which sometimes took the form of mild flirting and sometimes of much more than that. How much this might have been a direct effect of the drug and how much these were just people who'd been deprived of life and sort of, you know, released into normality.
Mm. In a sense, what you'd done, what the drug had done, was open a chemical window, hadn't it? And then that window just began to close again. Why couldn't it be opened again fully?
I think there just weren't enough nerve cells to keep it open. And finally, I think so much of the brain had been destroyed.
Record number 3.
I grew up in a household full of music and piano playing, but my own taste as a romantic adolescent went towards Chopin. And in particular, I loved the Rubinstein recordings of the mazurkas. I knew them all by heart myself, and this one was a particular favourite.
Chopin's Mazurka No. 1 in B flat major, Opus 7, played by Arthur Rubinstein. Do you play, Dr. Sachs?
I used to play. In fact, I used to know all the mazurkas by heart. And once, just after the war, when we were in Switzerland, we had a concert in a hotel and I played all the mazurkas.
You'd have been very little. Huh?
I was just 12 then, but that was sort of about the end of the piano for me. I had a very beloved music teacher who died when I was 11. And really, I've never played since.
But you still have a piano.
Oh, yeah, my father played a lot, and he gave me his Bechstein, a beautiful 8-foot Bechstein, but I'm afraid I hardly play it.
Your father was a doctor, wasn't he? A GP in North London, and your mother was a surgeon, which was unusual, presumably, I would have thought, anyway, in the early part of this
extremely,
century.
Extremely, yes.
And is it true that she had you dissecting a female body when you were still a young boy?
Yes, I was 14.
You must remember it vividly.
Well, I think a merciful repression has probably crept in, but I think it was rather a traumatic experience.
I bet. Did you fall inevitably into medicine then? Was there a sort of family pressure for you to become a doctor of some kind?
I suppose so, in a way, although all of us, I think, reacted against this and had other interests. My own love was for marine biology, and I got pushed into medicine slightly reluctantly.
But you had a love of poetry and reading too, didn't you?
I think so.
Didn't you form a literary society at school that got you into a bit of trouble?
Yes, well, I was at St. Paul's, and my contemporaries were Jonathan Miller and Eric Korn. And we were all biology lovers and all in the same form. But we also, between us, founded a literary society. And I was the president, and Jonathan was the secretary, and Eric was the treasurer. And we were inexcusably successful. And one day the High Master called me in, and he said, "Sax, you don't exist." And he annulled the society. I said, "You can't do that, sir. And why?" And he said, "I can do what I want, and I need give you no reasons." I mean, nowadays, of course, there'd be a revolt.
But why did he do it?
I don't know. I don't know. As I say, I think in some way we were too successful, or we were sort of, seen as talkative, aggressive, clever, intolerable young Jews.
But you'd also, as a boy of six, been evacuated for 4 years during the war, hadn't you? Separated from your family. Perhaps that was rather like being banned, like being told you didn't exist. Is that why it made such an impression on you?
I think the psychological impact of evacuation has never been properly described. It was overwhelming for me, but I was one of 3.5 million kids who were sent away. I was just six. I hardly saw my parents in 4 years or so. And that was a very, very evil, evil time of life. And I see with many of my contemporaries, at a glance, I can see that they too have been marked by evacuation. And certainly when I came back to London when I was just 10, my passion was for physics and chemistry and for the hard sciences where everything was predictable and stayed in place.
Let's have record number 4.
Well, going back to the early halcyon days before the war, my parents used to go to a musical, whatever, every week, and they had adored Cheech Chin Chow. And we had the score of this, and it used to be a family sing-song, and in particular my father, who was a huge man with a barrel chest with a great resonant bass, used to sing, "Here be oysters stewed in honey," and fricasseed sturgeon's roe. I can still hear him.
"Here be oysters stewed in honey, and conger eels cooled in snow. Here be shellfish stuffed with spices, and fricasseed sturgeon roe. Tails baked in butter, and plover's eggs from afar. Here be hummingbirds in jelly, and lizards from Zanzibar."
Martin Lawrence and the chorus of Cheech Chin Chow singing "Here Be Oysters." So you went up to Oxford in the 50s, Oliver Sacks, then to work at the Middlesex Hospital in London and then a hospital in Birmingham. But in 1960, when you would have been, 27, you went to Canada. And as far as living and working are concerned, you've never come back. So what was it then that captured you there?
I think the feeling of spaciousness and the West. I loved cowboy films. I love Fenimore Cooper, although that's not exactly the West. And I think I wanted a feeling of moral spaciousness as well, and perhaps there's a certain feeling that England or Europe was close and incestuous, and I'm still very nostalgic for the West Coast.
But eventually you went east, and you went to New York, and you became a real doctor, as it were. Mm-hmm. Your first book was, in fact, about migraine, wasn't it? And it enjoyed a certain popular success, because it wasn't just a textbook. You were doing that from the very beginning. It was a good read, so that non-specialists could read it, lots of case histories. You suffer from migraine yourself, and you've arrived here with one. Does that mean to say you were dreading coming here?
Well, the timing's wrong. I expected to have one tomorrow. I thought I hoped I would rise to the occasion and then fall into a migraine, but I woke up with a real blind this morning. And
You woke up because you're also an insomniac, aren't you?
Yeah. But this time I think migraines sometimes gets into dreams, and I had a funny dream about people with the middle of their face missing. And then when I woke up, I had the so-called bagel vision. When I looked at the Times, I saw a ring of newsprint and a blank in the middle. Mm. Anyhow, that's gone now.
What else don't you like? You don't like heat very much, do you?
No, I don't like heat. I'm a bit of a claustrophobe.
Don't like darkness?
No, I don't like darkness. I'm afraid of the dark. I keep a light on.
Perhaps it's why you don't sleep.
Perhaps so.
But you also take notes wherever you go. You've got a pocket full of pencils, yes, of various kinds, right, and a book, which you have by you even as we speak.
Right. I think this has been part of my life probably since I was about 8 or 9. I don't know whether it's taking notes, but some creation of a verbal equivalent of experience or re-experiencing in words is right at the heart of me. And I need to do it as I need to breathe.
Let's have some more music.
I love Mozart opera, often without knowing the plot or the characters too well. I think I love Don Giovanni above all, and especially that dramatic scene where he is claimed and goes down to hell.
Final scene of Mozart's Don Giovanni, sung by Eberhard Wächter and Giuseppe Taddei, and the Philharmonia Chorus, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. How do you work these days, Oliver Sacks? Do you have smart consulting rooms now you're a celebrity and people come to see you and pay you large fees? Or are you still on the wards, so to speak?
I'm basically on the wards. I spend 3 days working in hospitals. Most of these are chronic hospitals or charity hospitals. I see an occasional private patient, perhaps one a month.
But making money out of such people worries you, does it? Out of people with the sort of problems?
I think so, and I was always very bad at charging and never could.
So you move around New York, as it were, in the day, going from one institution to another, seeing various different kinds of patients. I read that in one particular institution in the Bronx, you're always terrified that you'll be mistaken for a patient and kept in.
Oh, yes. Well, this was in the State Hospital, and I'm always very careful. I was always very careful there to wear my white coat and my identification. I think perhaps at that time my beard was longer and I maybe looked a little bit more eccentric. But it might be difficult to prove one was sane.
You have, as you just said, a beard and the gold-rimmed spectacles. Really, you look very much, or Robin Williams looked very much like you in the film, except that you're much larger than he is, aren't you?
Right. And now when I adjust my glasses, people say I'm imitating Robin.
But he portrayed you as shy, gauche, insecure, as well as compassionate and deeply sincere. I mean, it's a terribly difficult question for you to answer, really, but do you feel that it was a reasonably accurate portrayal?
I think it was probably a somewhat sentimentalised one. I think there's probably a driving curiosity, which may be the most central thing in me. And I'm not always compassionate. Yeah. I sometimes have to pull myself back and remind myself that I mustn't go too far.
Because, as you say, a driving curiosity, and you've got the notebook and you're writing a narrative on these people you see all of the time, one almost has the impression that you're an explorer, if you like, of the mind. And I suppose you get do you hooked up on that line of exploration and perhaps leave behind the human dimension? Is that fair?
I think there's certainly a danger with this. As a child, my favourite reading was Darwin and the Galapagos or Bates on the Amazon and sort of natural history explorations. And you can't quite have natural history explorations of a human being. He is an other facing you.
The character, the Robin Williams character we keep mentioning, you, that is, also tells Leonard, the patient, at one point that he isn't married because he's no good with people. Is that true of you, too?
I'm not very good at dealing with people, and I think I probably prefer the defined roles of physician, investigator, explorer, or whatever.
Next record.
I mentioned earlier that I used to love reading Darwin. I still love reading Darwin. Above all, I like to imagine how he must have felt when he visited the Galapagos, where he saw evolution and creation happen. I also wonder, the literary part of me, if you want, wonders how Melville felt when he went to the Galapagos 4 years later and saw the dawn of creation there. And there's a wonderful piece which Melville wrote called the Incantadas about a half-allegorical Galapagos. A few months ago, I heard an amazing rendering of this in which the text was recited by Gielgud and set to music by a very gifted young American musician, Tobias Picker, in the seemed to me a miraculous juxtaposition of text and voice and music.
Let us first glance low to the lowermost shelf of all. What outlandish beings are these? Erect as men, they stand all round the rock like sculptured caryatides, supporting the next range of eaves above.
Sir John Gielgud reading from the Encantadas by Tobias Picker with the Houston Symphony conducted by Christoph Eschenbach. What you deal in, your business really, is in the deficiencies of the brain, the lack of something that the rest of us take for granted, like the man who mistook his wife for a hat. Like the man with a warped sense of the vertical who walked in a leaning sort of way, rather like the Tower of Pisa. You couldn't help him in terms of making his brain better, but you did give him practical help, didn't you?
Well, he very beautifully suggested the solution to his own difficulties. He wondered if there was a sort of spirit level in the brain and if this was damaged in him, and I said yes. And he then wondered if one might not have such a level in the rim of the glasses and use this, and I said, yes, that's a great idea, let's try it.
So what, did you put two little spirit levels above the...
Yes.
So he just had to keep peering up to make sure he was vertical?
Yes.
What about the man whom you could treat with drugs, the man with Tourette's syndrome? He twitched like a kind of demented tic-tac man, but who only wanted to be cured in the week and not at weekends. Tell me about him.
This man, while he was very disabled in a way by the sudden movements and violences of his Tourette's, was also a very gifted amateur musician and a brilliant improviser at jazz, and some of his improvisations would start with a tick which would immediately be elaborated. And when he was put on medication to calm him down, he lost a lot of his playfulness and his creative ability. On the other hand, he was able to hold a steady job. And so after a while he suggested that we should have him in two parts, that he should be steadied for Monday to Friday and kept sober, square with a drug, and he would be taken off it and let fly at weekends.
Does he still do that?
He still does that. He's a lovely man, and he's really a friend now, and this is now 22 years, and this double life has been quite stable.
Record number 7.
I found myself in quite a deep depression after my mother's death in 72. And first there was a proper mourning, then I think a sort of melancholia, and in the sort of state the world curdles and coagulates and becomes horrible and meaningless and dark and hopeless. And I was in this very grim state and walking along when I suddenly felt a change of mood and a sort of lightness and a slight memory of life. And then I realised that I was hearing some music. And this music was redemptive to me. I felt if I could hold on to that music, I could climb out of this evil state, and Black Dog would leave me alone. It's a rather obscure, rarely known piece. I don't know that it's terribly distinguished, but for me, it was redemptive.
One of Schubert's variations on a theme, Trockenerblumen from Die Schöne Müderin, played by Alain Marion and Pascal Roger. You'd be all right on the desert island, I think, Dr. Sachs, because you're a water lover, aren't you?
I'm a passionate water lover, as my father was. I always carry my flippers with me.
You've got them here, I
know. Oh, indeed, I have. I have them right here.
And you have Uradeel, or the feet of a Uradeel, Jonathan Miller told you.
These are the sort of fat, the flat, splayed feet of a giant amphibian. Jonathan's no one to talk, but he has size 15 feet himself.
But yours are what? Yours must be that big.
Yes, mine are perhaps broader, but still, I want flippers as well.
Right. So swimming's an important part of your life, then?
A crucial part of my life.
And you spend a lot of time in the bath?
Yes, indeed, in the bath.
And you're not very practical. You don't cook for yourself, do you? I mean, you're not going to cope on this island in that sense, are you?
I think one can cope without cooking. I expect to harvest from the sea an enormous number of invertebrates, which as a former marine biologist I will be able to identify. I enjoy eating every phylum. I mean, I will know which sea anemones to eat and which jellyfish.
So all of that will work. And also, perhaps you wouldn't suffer loneliness because, as we've said, you're very wary of people. You don't like their illogicality. Perhaps you'd be really quite pleased to have got away from them.
I think on the island, though of course I would be an unemployed physician, a doctor who no longer has any patients, I think I would carry with me extremely vivid memories of the patients and the characters I've seen over the last 30 years. They're still intensely alive for me. But of course I'd be lonely. Anyone would.
Last record.
I think on an island like this, to survive, you'd need to have some sort of project. Now, there's a particular composer whom I hate. I think he's awful, and I can't stand any of his music, but I'm assured that he's very, very great. And I don't know why I have this odd loathing of Beethoven, but perhaps given all the time on the world, I could enter what everyone else tells me is his sublime world, and particularly the world of the final quartets.
Part of Beethoven's string quartet in C-sharp minor, Opus 131, played by the Amadeus Quartet, which I presume is not the one out of the eight that you'd keep in that case, Oliver Sacks.
Well, it would be Project Beethoven. I mean, perhaps he would become my favourite. But no, I think what I want to keep is the Mass, is the B minor Mass.
The Bach.
The Bach.
What about your book?
Well, this business of having only 8 records to choose from has tantalised me. I think I would like to take a book which was a very favourite book of my father's, and this is A Dictionary of Musical Themes by Barlow and Morgenstern. This book was published in 1949, and it contains 10,000 musical themes. And my father would open the book and leaf over the pages, and then suddenly one of the themes would come to life in his imagination and play for him. And this way, I feel my repertoire would be increased from 8 to 10,000.
Sounds like a luxury, actually. What is your luxury?
I think that the sea and marine life is closer to my heart than anything else, and I think, therefore, a snorkel or, if possible, a scuba apparatus so that I could swim in the sea, be with my fellow creatures. I think that would be the happiest thing for me.
And you're never without your flippers anyway, so
no.
You're half-equipped anyway, and we shall provide the rest. Oliver Sacks, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.